I'm told there's an entire craft at Wright Patt underground, Dayton, Ohio, Wright Patterson Air Force Base. I'm also told that there are entities there as well.
I listened to the testimony of U.S. defense personnel who've tried to engage with the anomalous technology, and they often talk about the craft moving as if the craft were conscious, as if the craft were creatures rather than pieces of technology being piloted. And so I wonder if there's something interesting about the materials we've got that is slightly blurring whether we're looking at biologics or technology, and that's why they've got Gary Nolan.
But there were panels or something on the craft that looks like you just put your hands on it, and that there would be a connection like between the human body or whatever and the craft itself, almost like it was alive as well.
Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Go to surfshark.com/fifthkind and get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
James Fox is a prolific filmmaker on the topic of ufology and disclosure. His movies include Pretty Slick, UFOs, 50 Years of Denial, Out of the Blue, The Phenomenon, Moment of Contact, a must-see in my book. And we're talking to him today about his latest movie, The Program, which is number one on Apple and Amazon as we speak. James Fox, welcome to the Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
It's great to have you back with us. You are making movies at an incredible rate of knots. I really enjoyed this latest. It's called The Program, which is a reference to what's known as the Legacy Program. And I think viewers on this channel will know what that is. It's talking about units within U.S. military intelligence whose job it is to reverse engineer materials obtained through UFO retrievals. And until a couple of years ago, that was the stuff of pure conspiracy theory. But all that's changed. So perhaps you could begin by talking us through how that has changed and what the state of play is today.
It's insane. You know, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and people often ask me, like, well, they used to, a little less nowadays, but they used to look at me and go, why do you do what you do and you keep doing the same thing? Like, are you okay? And I'd say, well, let me ask you a question. If the government or governments had definitive proof that they were concealing from the general public that would prove that we're not alone in the universe, how significant of a story would you consider that being? And everyone says, oh, my God, well, if it was true, it would be, oh, that's it. That's the biggest story in modern history. So, you know, obviously, I'm convinced it's happening. And honestly, like, you know, you missed one of my films. I know what I saw, a 2-hour special. I must be crazy. I keep making. And the one thing I've learned is, like, every time I say I'm not going to do another UFO documentary, I make another UFO documentary. Because for me, it's like a personal journey, right? I really want answers. I'm just super curious. I'm not a physicist. I'm not a former military. I'm not sort of so-called experiencer. I'm just Joe Public that decided I want to find out what's going on and started sticking my teeth in. So if you look at my movies, you know, 50 Years of Denial, I talk a little bit about Roswell because at the time when I was making that, the 50th anniversary was coming up and it was all in the news and there was Congressman Schiff talking about it and the secrecy. And then, of course, Philip Corso came forward for the 50th anniversary in Roswell. But apart from covering Roswell, an alleged crash in 1947, if you look at my films from there, I do Out of the Blue, Out of the Blue 2. I do I Know What I Saw. I really don't cover crash retrievals. I don't cover Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I primarily stuck with Close Encounters of the First and Second Kind for the better part of 25 years. And then I put my neck out and went all in on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which is where, for your audience, I'm sure they know this already, but which is where the witness claims to see entities connected, associated with the craft. And I say entities because whatever you want to call them, NHI, non-human intelligence, aliens, beings, whatever. And then I decided to do a film on a UFO crash in Brazil that I'd been investigating on and off for 12 years. And that was right after I'd finished The Phenomenon, which I know is a slippery slope because, like, honestly, in the mainstream, people really weren't talking other than Roswell, which had been beaten to death. People really weren't talking about that. They weren't talking about, like, aliens being recovered and UFOs crashing and Americans involved, particularly in a foreign country. I mean, it was like, you know, and I had people that I'm very close with, very respected in the field saying, you know, are you sure this is the direction you want to go in? And, you know, you've got a great reputation. You've just coming off the heels of tremendous success with The Phenomenon. You really, you know, managed to create a body of evidence that's transcended the UFO community, penetrated a mainstream audience. You got, you know, all these household names like Senator Harry Reid, who was former Senate Majority Leader, Podesta, and, you know, intelligence folks. And you could jeopardize all those contacts. But I thought, you know, I believe it happened, and I'm going to report on it. And I'll just keep my mouth shut until the film's done, it's out. And that's exactly what I did. Now, what I didn't realize, and what I could have never predicted, was that 5 months after the film's release, roughly, there would be a high-level intelligence officer testifying in front of a bipartisan group of lawmakers under oath in an open congressional hearing that we have a crash retrieval program and that biologics were recovered. I'm going, that's exactly what Moment of Contact's about. And then the government and the U.S. government involvement. So naturally, I think, you know, the program, and I called it the program because all the intel folks that I was interviewing and meeting with, and some that I just, that were out in the news, referred to it as the program. I'm not saying that's the technical word for it within the government. One, you know, I'm sure there's lots of different names, but they refer to it as the program. So that was a natural progression for me to go from The Phenomenon, Moment of Contact. Now I'm going to go knocking on doors in Washington, D.C. and find out, you know, what's known about a crash retrieval program. But again, David Grush opened the door for me and made that work a lot easier.
2023 was an incredible year with that July 26th hearing. David Grush was really the key witness, but he testified under oath alongside David Fravor, Ryan Graves. How did that happen? Because a lot of people watching that from the sidelines were asking how his complaint had been allowed to escalate into something so public. And one assumes that there must be other people in the mix who are in a forward-leaning posture with regard to disclosure. I mean, without DOPSA taking a particular line and without ISIG, Thomas Monheim, taking a particular line, that hearing would never have happened. There was clearly a push and pull around it because there was quite a reaction against it. The very next day, there was a fierce and angry reaction from the ATIP leader,
Sean Kirkpatrick.
So now, how do you read it?
On LinkedIn.
Yes, there you are. How was it allowed to happen? And how do you read the push and pull of disclosure in that event?
So I remember, it's funny, I was actually, because I posted up in Washington, D.C., and I really didn't have a lot of like interviews lined up. I mean, I was really kind of winging it, quite honestly. And but I, you know, I talked to Chris Mellon. And he's like, I'll be back and forth during that time. I said, look, I'm bringing in a whole bunch of gear. I got a couple of guys. One guy, David West, who's my DP, coming from Southern California. Another guy in Texas who does these incredible, Matthew. He does these incredible like time lapse motion shots where you have to get permits all across DC. Beautiful imagery. And if you've ever seen that series on Netflix called House of Cards. Mm-hmm. You got those beautiful motion time lapse. So you set up tracks with these little carts on cameras, and they move very, very slowly, right? And then when you speed them up, the movement is like almost a normal speed, but then the clouds are whizzing overhead. Beautiful effect. I loved it. And I really wanted to, because Washington, D.C. was the epicenter of this unprecedented push for open, you know, government transparency on this topic. And so anyway, so I told Chris Mellon, I said, look, I'm basically winging it. I've got a couple of interviews lined up. I'm coming to DC and I'll be there for 4 to 5 weeks with a whole crew. And when I'm not interviewing people, sit down interviews, I'm going to be in the streets capturing absolutely jaw dropping, beautiful, you know, B-roll of DC area. And so, and that's how it worked out. And so I just posted myself up there for the better part of 5 weeks with the crew and started getting, you know, interviews, and just things started to happen. And Mellon connected me with a whistleblower that was a whistleblower behind closed doors. And I remember I connected with Leslie Kane at the time, and Leslie was in talks with Grush and Grush's lawyer, who was the first ICIG Inspector General of the intelligence community, struggling to remember his name, but in any case, and I could hear the fear in Grush's voice. Not that I was eavesdropping on all the bits of conversation, but Grush was very concerned about his safety. I mean, he sounded very scared, like very concerned for not just his career, but his personal safety. And I remember I never felt a sense of urgency. I never felt that before in all my years of production, where it was like, this is real. Like the fear factor is real. And, you know, so he came forward because he was set out. Congress gave him the credentials needed, the clearances needed to find, you know, what intelligence agencies knew. And guess what? He pulled back the curtain and found it, right? And there were consequences to that. And I think that he felt the only way that he was going to be comfortable for his personal safety and his wife's personal safety was to go fully public. And so that's what they did. In fact, yeah. Leslie was working with New York Times. They were dragging their feet, trying to do like 100 million verifications. And it was happening too slow. Then it was the Washington Post. And they wanted to take like another month. They didn't have that time. Then she went to Politico. Politico said, give us a week. David Grush was like, no, I need to go public now. He was getting threats at the time. And so they ended up going with the debrief. And then Ross Coulthart, obviously with News Nation, my buddy Scott Carlin, who used to run HBO, made that happen. Excuse me, made that happen. And that's how it came out. And then, you know, I'm sure that, you know, Jeremy and a number of other people behind the scenes were working with Burchett. Because remember, if you've seen the program, Burchett attends the first congressional hearing that Congressman Andre Carson put on. And you see Burchett. I didn't notice it before. I noticed it after. You see Burchett sitting there in the audience, basically looking at the intel folks, just kind of rolling his eyes. So Burchett, you know, he was sharpening his knives for a second round. And yes. And then they made that happen. But look, there are some people on the inside, you know, some people just have this knee-jerk response to anybody in the intelligence agency or anybody in the government is bad. That's not the case. There's some good people out there that really do want to get to the bottom of this and are willing to put their necks out. And it's important for the general public to know that, understand that, and to continue the support of this unprecedented bipartisan. You don't see Democrats and Republicans working together on a lot of things, very many things in government, but this is one thing that's really brought them together, and it's an exciting time.
It seems to me that hearing would have been a lot quieter if DOPSA had taken a stricter line on things. And I'm not an expert in how everything works stateside, but I think also without Thomas Monheim, it probably wouldn't have happened. Were you able to talk to Thomas Monheim at all and get an understanding?
Tried. No, he it was wouldn't. An ongoing investigation, and it was absolutely just a hard no. And he just stepped down a couple of days ago.
Oh, okay.
What I do know is that so he would theoretically be a citizen or a civilian now. I think, and I've been pushing this, he needs to be, well, so he should be subpoenaed and he should testify if we can. And maybe there are certain aspects of that I'm naive about, but he's got the street addresses. He's got all the specifics needed to verify the claims from David Grush. And I'll remind your audience, you know, there was another congressional hearing, a third congressional hearing in 3 years in November of 2024. And it was, in fact, one of the first congressional hearings that I got to attend. And it wasn't anywhere near as sensational as David Grush. Nonetheless, people did testify. You know, two people in particular that caught my eye was Tim Gallaudet, Rear Admiral, who talked about objects underwater that were exhibiting a technology that was impossible. You know, and then you had, you know, who ran the ATIP program, Lou Elizondo, or one of them, you know, testify, you know, under oath that there's a crash retrieval program. I mean, that's not a nothing burger. And then, of course, Michael Schellenberger, having a name to work with, Immaculate Constellation. I mean, we've heard about a repository somewhere where all this high resolution data is kept. I mean, everybody's been talking. I mean, Gary McKinnon went to jail for looking for it and found some of it. So, it makes perfectly good sense. They would have a name, you know, for they've got it somewhere. Right. So I thought it was, it was amazing to be there. It was amazing to experience it in person.
The hearing created a real new momentum in this whole journey of disclosure. And there were senators and members of Congress who really from there decided there should be a legislative push to move ownership of artifacts within the program to the government, that the government should own these, and that the process of disclosure, what the public is allowed to know, should be handed to a presidential panel. And these were provisions entered into the defense procurements bill that was being put together in 2023. It had bipartisan support. It passed in the Senate, and then the House slapped it down. Why did it fail, and how did it fail?
Well, a couple things. I mean, I've talked to some people that have materials in labs, and they're like, well, eminent domain, yeah, we're not too happy about that. And so basically, my understanding of it that has been explained to me, it's the National Defense Authorization Act of 2023 that was Rounds and Schumer and Rubio and Gillibrand. I'm trying to think who else. Anyway, basically, I guess that it would require anyone in possession of so-called metamaterials, you know, for better part, anything recovered that's alien in nature, to the government. And they didn't like that. A lot of people didn't like that. Now, that was one aspect of it. But there was another thing that David Grush was very frustrated about, and I don't quite blame him. It were two people in the House, Mike and Mike, and I'm trying to think of their last names.
Mike Rogers and Mike Turner.
Mike Rogers and Mike Turner, thank you. And I think that David and those guys fought like hell to prevent this. It might have been the 2024 legislation, but I'm not entirely sure. Don't quote me on that, because there was two different things, legislation that was that was put forth, one in 2023 and one in 2024. It was actually signed in December of 2022 for 2023, and then another one was signed in December of 2023 for 2024. And Grush says, you know, these are the two that had the highest level of opposition to this thing passing. And if you look at their biggest donors, it's Raytheon, Lockheed, like the other guy's district is like, you know, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is like so obvious what happened, you know.
Yes.
The
fact that it was those two gentlemen, Mike Rogers and Mike Turner, who really played a key part in defeating that bill, really shines a light on who the major players are in this process. The fact that the program has been privatized to what Ike Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. So that's the aerospace industry. And so attention ought now to be sort of squarely on Northrop Grumman, Skunk Works, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing. Should we be banging on their doors rather than banging on the doors of the Pentagon to find out what's really going on?
Well, I mean, you know, Representative Tim Burchett of Tennessee talks about that. And it was like it was set up that way by design, right? Because Congress, the way he explained it, we can, if you have like a subcontract, let's say that Congress, the U.S. government's got a contract with, let's say, Raytheon, right? Subcontract. So whoever has the subcontract deal with that outside entity, that private corporation, they can be subpoenaed in, but the company, the entity like Raytheon cannot because it's private. So it's like set up that way by design. So it's one layer removed from government oversight, right? And then another thing that was explained to me, and I'm learning as I go along here, right? I'm just as curious as the next person. How does one hide a project get funding, like we are, and it was explained to me that it's most likely under the bigger umbrella of the DOE Department of Energy, and that it's called a waived unacknowledged special access program, and it's the least amount of oversight. There are some people, my understanding, that are read into it, but look, they're getting hip to what's going on. They're getting hip. People are coming forward. A number of firsthand witnesses, Kirk McConnell talks about that in the program, Senate Armed Services Committee staff member who investigated the issue from 2017 to 2024. And I think he said, him and others, there have been somewhere between 8 and 12 firsthand witnesses that have gone into a skiff privately and had meetings with staff members and people in the Senate about the program. Firsthand, so people that are actually working inside on the program. So they're getting, okay. They believe me, they have street addresses. I don't know if you notice in the movie, it's something that I hear very few people talk about. That's kind of a big deal for me. I think it should be a big deal for most people, but not that many people who watch the program maybe either catch it or understand the significance of it. But Chris Mellon has got a redacted document that is that he went through the Dobser process and the names were redacted, but there was an unredacted version provided to select members of Congress. And my understanding that the new head of Aero, John Kosklowski, and that has, as of 2020, the name of the gatekeeper to the crash retrieval program. I mean, they have that name. That person's alive and kicking. Whether he's still the gatekeeper today or not, I don't know. But they have a name.
Did you get any sense of whether that name was what Admiral Wilson is claimed to have called a corporate type, or is it someone in government?
I wish I knew. I really don't know. But I've heard that they're in and out.
Yes, okay.
They've got there one foot in and one foot out.
Yes, understood.
I know it's frustrating, right? Everybody wants more, but you know, a lot's happened in the last few years.
It really has. So much has changed, really, since 2017.
Unbelievable.
When the New York Times ran with that story, thanks to Leslie King.
I never ever thought that was going to happen. I never thought that I'd be asking sitting members of Congress, do we have alien spaceships in our possession and alien bodies, without being laughed out of the room and ostracized for the rest of my life from ever coming, stepping foot back into Washington, D.C., you know? I mean, I never thought when I was making the, I was 2015, 2016. I was 5 years in to making the phenomenon when that story dropped, right? December 2017, front page, New York Times. Do you think I saw that coming? And look, I know Leslie, and I've known Leslie forever. I was the first person to put her on camera for Out of the Blue with Tim
Coleman. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And so, she kept that secret from me as well. And she knew I was working on a documentary because I interviewed her.
So and the key players there were Leslie Keen and, of course, Chris Mellon.
Yes.
Chris Mellon, tell us a little bit about him, because he's been quite important in moving the conversation forward. How is he able to do that? How is he still alive? He seems to have some little cone of protection around him that allows him to do what he does.
Sorry, I was just readjusting my shoe there. He comes from the Mellon family. So that's I don't know if one would consider it on the par of Rockefeller, but it's certainly up there. So high profile, well-to-do, established family, extremely intelligent, former, deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence. He demands respect. He knows how these things work. He's got connections on the inside. It's amazing. I don't think he's anywhere nearly recognized as how much he deserves. And he doesn't really do that. He doesn't do it for that. He's not an attention seeker at all. I had to beg him to participate in this film, and he's like, I don't know, James. My wife really wants me to kind of take a step back. But I have to remind the audience, and I'm sure a lot of you know this already, but it wasn't like the government had some sort of, epiphany in 2017 and decided that the general public needs to know more or there needs to be more transparency on this topic. It was a couple of people working on the inside that decided to take action in their own hands, and they found a loophole and walked those tapes out of the Pentagon and onto the front page of the New York Times. That's how it all happened. And Chris Mellon is the one that walked those tapes out. I mean,
yes,
he found a loophole, but he was still, still taking a chance. Still taking a chance, because, everybody wants that evidence. What?
Getting back to the technicalities of the program.
Yes.
So they're working on materials. They're seeking to reverse engineer materials, reproduce materials with the same properties. And this has been privatized to certain groups within the aerospace industry. They're able to do this because of massive black budgets, or whatever we should call them. There then has to be a financial incentive on those corporations not to disclose their progress too quickly. By privatizing the whole thing, haven't we inevitably slowed down the process of disclosure?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And I think the program is the first time I really kind of explored the politics of disclosure, right? And I never really thought as in depth about it, the complexities of it, as I did with Hal Puthoff, who's in the film, who was in somewhat an official capacity set up to, along with a number of other people, to kind of review the pros and cons of disclosure and how it might go about. And because let's just say that, let's just put all of our skeptics aside for a moment and just say that it's true, that we really do have recovered debris and we have bodies and we have definitive proof, okay? Well, we know that the technology exhibited that these things can do is just light years advanced from anything that we have. The military, inevitably, I'm sure, if they were able to reverse engineer it or not, I don't know, successfully, would want to weaponize it, right? Because, you can get a significant advantage. You imagine putting weapons on an object that can, fly rings around the fastest planes and rockets and, I mean, make a mockery of all that. That would be a massive advantage. Or if you think about it, what happens if that stuff, that technology gets into the wrong hands? You know, then we could be dominated, right? So I thought about like how it would be. I explored this just the other day. I was like, well, let's see. They could say, the government come out and say, well, yes, it's true. This crash retrieval program is real. And we do have, you know, biologics and debris from a number of cases over spanning, you know, over 80 years. Then, you know, it's a global implications, right? It's not just in the United States. So then what happens? Well, a lot of people aren't going to believe the government because the trust level in the government is so low. So, all right, prove it. Well, now they're going to have to show what they've got. Are they going to be worried about that getting into the wrong hands? How do they do it? How do they make that announcement and then prove that they have it? It's such a, I don't even know, quite honestly. I've thought about it now. And they could say, well, you could take our word for it. We have it. Maybe they could take a panel of international prominent scientists into one of the labs, show them what they've got, and they could all vouch. Take picture, you know. People are going to say it's AI. Like, how do you do it? How do you execute that? I honestly don't know. I mean, if the president of the United States comes forward and says, my fellow Americans, it's been brought to my attention, you know, then what?
Mm.
You can't make that claim and not back it up with proof. They're going to want proof. Are you going to give? I don't know. I really don't know how.
What how we've had up. Yeah, for sure. It's complex, for sure. What we've had up until now. Complex.
I used to just think, oh, the president can just make an announcement. Oh, isn't that cool? And everyone would be like, wow, that's amazing. We're not alone. Group hug. not so fast.
What we have had up until now is little bits of information sort of seeping out at the edges. And then it's almost as if military intelligence is watching and waiting for the public reaction to the little bits of information that are getting out there. And I think maybe an example of this is clearly the greatest proportion of the work on the program is absolutely behind closed doors. But at the tip of the iceberg, we have heard from people associated with the program, and that would be the physicist Jacques Vallée, astrophysicist Jacques Vallée, physicist Eric Davis, microbiologist, immunologist Gary Nolan. They have talked about their work on metamaterials. And so I'm interested in, first of all, what's an immunologist? What's a microbiologist doing working on metamaterials? And what are those materials? What has been said publicly about what they have and are working on?
You know, I tried to get more details when I got to the opportunity a few years ago to go in the lab with Gary Nolan and Jacques Vallée, and I am no scientist, but can you put it in layman's terms? Like, what are we doing here? Why, how, you know, how is it different? And Yes. So basically my understanding of it is, and it's rudimentary, but that he had built a special device to look at things at the atomic level, like really get down and look at it. And I guess maybe, and he was also talking, I think, a little bit about, he's also an experiencer. So I'm pretty sure he got contacted by some government officials that brought him in because, as a lot of other physicists have said, it's been so compartmentalized and stovepiped that they really have not had the full force of the intellectual heavyweights within the scientific community globally to participate and really make progress on what they have because of the levels of secrecy, right? So there's like, I'm told that very little progress is made. Now, that, you know, that could be inaccurate. Maybe they have successfully reverse engineered and figured out this anti-gravitics, you know, like case in point. Some people feel that the 1990 Calvine UFO photograph, which I think is the best photograph ever taken of a UFO that's in the public domain, that is a secret government prototype, experimental craft within some unknown government agency in the U.S. I find that hard to believe just because of the technology exhibited by this thing and the levels of secrecy with it and that they've gone through. But if that's true, if that is true, that really is a craft that, 34 years ago, coming up on 35 years ago, then someone's been doing a pretty damn good job of hiding this revolutionary technology that would certainly replace everything that runs on Jet A fuel. I don't know. I really don't. I tend to think not, but from the people that I've talked to and I've met, and they could be wrong as well. They could be wrong as well. I don't know. I think it's not non-human intelligence personally.
Yes. The phrase that David Grush used in that hearing was non-human biologics. We're now hearing more about non-human intelligence. It's slightly vague language, and I'm just sort of trying to put two and two together and thinking they've got Gary Nolan. He's a microbiologist. He's an immunologist. He's analyzing materials from UFO retrievals. And then I listened to the testimony of U.S. defense personnel who've tried to engage with the anomalous technology. And they often talk about the craft moving as if the craft were conscious, as if the craft were creatures rather than pieces of technology being piloted. And so I wonder if there's something interesting about the materials we've got that is slightly blurring whether we're looking at biologics or technology. And that's why they've got Gary Nolan.
You know, I remember, and a lot of people say that this individual is quite controversial, but it was Philip Corso. I tend to lean in the direction that he's telling the truth. However, there were a number of inaccuracies in his book, Roswell the Day After, or the Day After Roswell, that was presented at the 50th anniversary of Roswell. Philip Corso, colonel in the Army. And he had told me that talked about symbiotic. And I kept saying, what do you mean by symbiotic? And he said, well, that the craft would somehow, this was just probably him speculating, I don't know, or lying, I don't know. But he said that, and a number of other people said this as well, that there were panels or something on the craft that it looks like you just put your hands on it, and that there would be a connection like between the human body or whatever, and the craft itself, almost like it was alive as well. That was explained to me like 25, maybe 30, I don't know, 27 years ago. I remember hearing about that, and the word they used was symbiotic. And so maybe, but yeah. Again, I'm not a scientist, and I really don't know what I'm talking about.
No, it's really intriguing, isn't it? I'd love really to dig into that
a little bit further. I'd love to know how much progress they've made. I'd love to know where they put the bodies. I'm told there's an entire craft at Wright Patt underground, Dayton, Ohio, Wright Patterson Air Force Base. I'm also told that there are entities there as well. But those are people that shared that with me that will remain anonymous, but that I certainly trust. Obviously, there's stuff elsewhere. Lockheed Martin's got stuff, and Raytheon's got stuff. Somebody was telling me that the 1953, and it's actually in the memo in the film The Program. I don't know if you remember that part or not. When I interviewed Christopher Mellon, that memo that he had,
yes.
They give it specific. They say Kingman, Arizona, 1953, or the 1950s, Kingman, Arizona. It was 1953, and I talked to a couple of people about that specific craft, and they said it landed. It didn't crash. I said, okay, how do we know that? Well, it was sitting on the ground, and they just walked away. I said, well, how do you know that? Maybe it was a drone. No, the door was open. They left the door open and just walked away. I was like, really? Yeah, and they said it didn't have a scratch on it. Not a scratch. Like it was absolute. And I don't know if we figured out how to fly it or not. I don't know.
That reminds me, just to flag this phrase, retrievals, because people often ask me, surely these craft can't travel interstellar distances with such precision and then crash when they get here. The word retrievals doesn't imply all these materials are from crashes, does it?
No. And you know, one of the things, one of the aspects of the Virginia UFO case that intrigued me were the witnesses that I talked to, the firsthand witnesses that I talked to that saw the cigar-shaped object in flying, right, before it crashed. They said it had a big gash in the back of it. I said, what do you mean? What? They said, yeah, it had a gash. And there was a weird white vapor coming out. They didn't say smoke, like a white vapor. It was different. And it was in trouble. It was struggling to stay in the air. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. I heard that from three different people. How did it get a gash? It was obviously struck by something. Was it struck by a meteorite? Was it struck by lightning? Was it us that shot at it? That always puzzled me and still puzzles me. Are we shooting these things down? Are there certain weapons perhaps that we're detonating that's affecting these things? You know, I think one of the reasons why they talk about NHI, non-human intelligence, is because, you know, what happens if they're right here? What happens if they're living underground? What happens if they're living in the oceans? What happens if they're interdimensional? Maybe they're not interplanetary, or maybe it's all of the above. There's some time travels. Maybe, you know, they're interplanetary. Like if you look at Betty and Barney Hill, they gave specifics, according to their testimony, on yes. where these individuals came from. You know, I mean, it's so complex, right? I remember getting involved with the phenomenon and started to investigate UFOs, now UAP, 30 plus years ago. And I was like, I'm going to do a documentary on UFOs and I'll find out what's going on. And I was thinking to myself, well, it's a big universe and, you know, it's probably just spilling over with life. And we get periodic visitation for whatever reason the governments decide to keep it quiet. And here I am 30 plus years later with so many more questions than I have answers. Yeah. And I think to myself, this is so much more complex because the phenomenon, whoever's behind it, they too are in on the secrecy. I'll give you a number of examples. I mean, case in point, Socorro, New Mexico. I've looked into that landing case. I think it's one of the most well-documented close encounters of the third kind in U.S. history. There were all kinds of evidence on the ground and burn marks and pod marks and footprints and number of people that saw the craft flying. Of course, Lonnie Zamora, the police officer on duty. But if you look at where they land, and I've been there many times, it was in an arroyo on the outskirts of town. So once they got down below a certain height, they were kind of hidden on the desert floor. And as soon as Lonnie, the police officer, rolled up on them, they got back in that craft and left immediately. You know, they could have stuck around, made contact. They didn't want to do that. You know, you look at Fire in the Sky, you look at Travis Walton, that case is phenomenal. And, you know, they cared enough about him because I guess he injured himself. He got exposed to the propulsion, whatever, as he got too close, as it was spooling up and ready to take off, and got exposed to something and knocked him out like a Raggedy Ann doll. And his buddies left and they came back. He was gone. And then they deposited him not in the same place where they took him. If they would have, I've been there in Snowflake, Arizona, up in the mountains, that mountain area, that's remote. If they would have dropped him off 5 days later up there, I guarantee you, he would have died. They didn't do that. They cared enough about his well-being, but they didn't want to expose themselves. So they waited till nightfall, roughly 5 days later, and they dropped him on the outskirts of town right near a phone booth. And they did it in a little valley, a little dip to minimize any. So they zipped down from high up in the sky, dropped him off, and then poo, took off, straight up, gone. So that's really interesting. I remember hearing it. I was like thinking to myself, well, gosh, they cared about his security. They cared about his safety, his well-being, but they damn straight didn't want to reveal their identity on a master scale. All they'd have to have done is hovered over the town in broad daylight and dropped him off. It would have been game over. They didn't do that. And they don't seem to do that. They do some pretty brazen things, but they don't like just, you know, rip the Band-Aid off and just make it, you know, like yeah. What was that one? Not Independence Day. What's that one where they just, that movie came out a couple of years ago. I'll think of it in a second. But they just basically started hovering over all the different cities, right? You know, it wasn't Contact. I'll think of it in a minute. But
on the topic of secrecy at the human end of the equation, anyone who regularly watches The Fifth Kind, anyone who's read my book, The Invasion of Eden, will know about the Wilson Davis notes. Now, these are allegedly the memo of a conversation between Admiral Thomas Wilson, who I think headed up the DIA, is that right? And yeah. Eric Davis, the astrophysicist, yeah. And they're talking about the program, who's running it, etc. These are the notes. So any of our viewers or readers know about these notes, but apparently Ronald Moultrie, U.S. Defense Undersecretary for Intelligence and Security, and Scott Bray, who's U.S. Naval Intelligence Deputy Director, have never heard of them. Do you believe them?
I kind of do.
How is that possible?
I know, right? I kind of do. I mean, those are just appointed by the president, right? I don't think those guys are like, what do you call, career intelligence folks. I think they're just puppets that get put up and just, you know, they probably have a minimum knowledge. I'm sure they knew a lot more than what they knew. But it wouldn't surprise me if they didn't know about that particular meeting. They might have heard rumors of a crash retrieval program or not, you know. They're not like what career intel insiders, right? Those are the people that you want to hear from. But look, I remember I was like, I gotta feature that document in it. And James Rigney from Australia had told me about it when I was at the tail end of production with The Phenomenon, whatever year that was. I'm sorry, it probably might have been 2020. Maybe he told me in 2019. I don't remember exactly when they were leaked out of Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut's house after he died. But I was so busy trying to get The Phenomenon out the door, and I was interested, but you know, he's like, oh, this is going to be the document of the century or of, you know, the biggest. And because what's interesting about the Wilson Davis memo is that nothing's redacted. All the names are there to see, right? And it's interesting because I read that memo. I watched all the podcasts on it. Richard Dolan gives great analysis on it. I called everybody I knew. I read it another 5 times. It's like, how am I going to present this in the program, you know, in a way that doesn't just get bogged down in all, oh, well, they came from here and then this happened and that. It's like, I just want to extract the essence of it out and reveal it. And it was, quite honestly, it was a huge boon to see that they were talked about in the first congressional hearing that Andre Carson put on, because that was a natural lead in. And then they're officially on the record. And I think that people like Hal Puthoff, who's mentioned in the documents, felt a little more comfortable to talk about. I mean, he didn't say they exist or they didn't exist. He basically says, I can't really talk about that. And if Eric Davis was willing to talk about it, I guess I would be willing to talk about it. But, yes. You know.
Well, neither Eric.
One more thing for you about this. This is funny. So I'm talking to Hal about it. And of course, I'm talking to other people about it, you know, off the record. In fact, I talked to Chris Mellon about it. And Chris goes, I don't feel comfortable talking about that. That's odd, really? Okay. So, but it says in there, he was head of the DIA. He was an admiral prior to that. Wilson.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm trying to think of his full name. But in any case, he says Admiral Thomas Wilson, if this document ever leaks, I will deny it emphatically. I'll never say it ever happened. So I contacted a few people that were in a position to subpoena him and bring him into a skiff and get the details. And they said, we talked to him. We wanted to bring him into a skiff and find out what he knows. And he says, well, I'm not really prepared to talk about it. You know, this other thing. And they said, that's okay. We'll get you in the skiff. And he goes, well, okay. He goes, if you want me to come into a skiff, I'll come into a skiff, but I will tell you in the skiff the same thing I'm telling you right now. It ain't going to happen.
So neither Admiral Wilson.
That's what he said he was going to do.
Yeah, exactly. Nor Eric Davis will speak about it, I understand, which kind of makes it more interesting. But the phrase, people know Eric phrases Davis, from it.
You know, we had a screening and at Soul Foundation just a couple of months ago of the program. And I'm told there was one person from the program, a first-hander who was there. Eric Davis was there as well. And Eric Davis sat right at the front. I sat right at the back. There was a lot of people, at least 400 people in the theater. It was packed. And got to that memo. And I had a friend of mine who was sitting next to Eric Davis. And he, you know, people were, when the memo came on, people were applauding. I mean, people were, woo, you know, Eric, you know. And he seemed kind of almost relieved that it was out. Like, you know, I think he made a few comments to this friend of mine, Nicole, about it. I don't know exactly what, and I wouldn't feel comfortable revealing that anyway, but he certainly didn't deny it. Let's put it that way. And
phrases from it's been taken pretty seriously, I would say.
Oh, yeah. Because
phrases from it have been quoted by mainstream media, and the juicy bits are off-world vehicles, not of this earth, not made by human hands. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect.
I love that aspect. That line in the movie just gives me goosebumps.
Yeah, same. And the other for me was Admiral Wilson's analysis that the key players were corporate types. And therefore there's a problem with accountability and ownership that arises from that. So I think that is well worth an avenue. That's an avenue we should all be following and paying attention to.
You know,
but I want to move on to someone else.
Oh, please.
Who you mentioned in the movie, another entertaining moment, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes.
Seems like a bright guy. And he's like one of the great luminaries of the age in terms of scientific knowledge. And what often happens on TV is if you're an expert in ABC, you'll be asked about XYZ. And so he's asked about the question of a populated cosmos. Are we in contact? And he comes out with a statement like this. Wouldn't ETs, and people say this all the time, wouldn't ETs manifest their presence more convincingly than on some fuzzy video? How is it that is as much as Neil deGrasse Tyson has seen and is aware of? Because there are far more important and convincing evidences and materials than that. How does he not know about them? And why is he the person that TV is asking these questions?
You know, it's amazing to me. And that was one of a very frustrating moment, particularly I'm meeting people that, you know, within the task force that have stepped down. In government insiders that had the clearances to have access to some of these more compelling data, right? Images, 4K, video, photographic, overhead, satellite. It's one of the only times I've ever cussed in any of my, in fact, it was probably the only time I've ever cussed in any movie I've ever did. We were in the heat of the moment having this discussion. I was, the frustration was palpable with me because I'm listening to all the mainstream scientific community being interviewed on the various news channels, and they're all like poo-pooing. You think they'd come? If they did, there'd be a little better data than just some blurry video from some, you know, really frustrating, you know. And and you look at Elon Musk, you know, and I actually had a conversation with someone the other day about Elon Musk with all those satellites. Like, surely. And they said to me, you know, and this is someone I really trust. They said, you know, he's got a lot of contracts with the DOD and he's got, you know, access and this. And I'd be shocked if he didn't know more about it, you know, but he would be in a position to know. But Neil deGrasse Tyson, just a mainstream, he's a physicist, right?
Yes.
And he's very bright. He's very bright and he's very likable. And I enjoy him a lot, but he's just dead wrong on this one. And it's amazing to me the level of curiosity that he has, that he hasn't once reached out and tried to talk to any of the witnesses. Like, go talk to Dave Fravor, you know, discuss this. I mean, it's the biggest question in the history of mankind. Are we alone? there are people coming forward claiming things that are extraordinary, you know, and he's a physicist and he's a public one and he's curious. Why doesn't he like show any more interest? In fact, he seems rather dismissive, which makes me think, I don't know, man. I don't know what to think about him.
You don't know what to think. That's right.
I really don't. I really don't. Very frustrating. And I hope to God that he gets to see this movie, because at least then he could say it's rumored from people allegedly in a position to know on the inside with the appropriate clearances that there's much better sensory data around the world collected to prove that these objects really do exist.
Now, what's your understanding of how much is known behind closed doors at an international level? Because what I wanted to do listening to Neil deGrasse Tyson was somehow get him the clearance to see all the images on JWICS. And that seems to be an international opportunity. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. Let's see.
Tell people what JWICS is.
Yeah. So it's basically, there's two things. I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember that because they're acronyms for.
Yes.
And I was going to say that I did an appearance at a press conference that was broadcast live at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Okay. And I managed to get myself in there, and the relevance behind what I'm saying will be clear in a second. And I kind of hold Bill Nelson, the head of NASA's, feet to the fire a bit, along with another individual. Thank God there's two of us.
Yes. And I'm going to come back to Bill Nelson in a minute.
Yeah. And then right after that press conference thing I did, I was the first in line to get a couple of questions in. I get contacted by an individual who was on the inside. That said, you know, I was contemplating coming forward. Your appearance at NASA really kind of motivated me to reach out. And long story short, we decide to meet in person, which we did. And this individual decided to give me an on-camera interview, but anonymously. Okay. And I'll take what I can get. And what this individual is saying was super consistent with what I'd been hearing from like Christopher Mellon and Len Val Logan of the task force and many others, Sarah Gamm, and people that have worked on the inside and had clearances and had access to JWICS. And you could tell us what Joint Worldwide, the acronym stands for.
Yes, it's the Joint Worldwide Intelligence Communications System. And the other acronym is SIPR, which is Secret Internet Protocol Router.
Yeah. So this individual gave as much information, you know, that he could during the interview, and basically brought up SIPR and brought up JWICS, said this is the place to go find this stuff. I've seen it. And he described in great detail. In fact, he described a number of cases that were so detailed and the locations and all this stuff coming in out of the oceans, yada, 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 that he said to me in the end, you know, I really don't feel comfortable with the level of detail I gave you about some of those specific UAP encounters from the sensory data. Would you mind leaving that part out? I was like, okay, but you're anonymous. I'm sorry. I feel a little uncomfortable. But he did give us JWICS and SIPR and, you know, the search engine, that sort of thing. Fast forward, I'm in, I would say the Pentagon, because it's Pentagon is here, and across the freeway is the headquarters for the new Aero All Domain Anomalous Resolution Office, and the new head is John Kosklowski, and I was there with a gentleman who goes by Kevin, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, and I got it was really weird, kind of a backstory to how I got in there, why we met, but we're basically going after the same footage that they asked me not to talk about because it could interfere with their investigation and mine. So I said, okay, I won't. But they said, you can say that you came here, you met with us, you talked. And I'm sitting there, in their office, and I'd gone into I was in a skiff. And I did the 48-hour background check. I went through the metal detector, and then they had these like glass tubes and like one side opened, and I think Len Val Logan had talked about what those glass tubes were, somebody else. But one side opened, and you step in, and then that closes, another one opens, and you go through, and it's like, you know, it was like a movie or something. You know, I couldn't believe I was in there, and I was sitting down in the office. Just prior to that, they were walking me through the halls, and it was amazing because I've always thought of a skiff in particular. I just thought a skiff would be synonymous with like a sort of a bunker, like a big, you know, bank vault door, which they did have a door like that. But I was thinking like, and then you're in a room with a little like oval table and, you know, secure walls, no windows. I was expecting that, but it was actually like office spaces. The whole thing was a skiff, right? And they walked me down the hallway, just one of them, Kevin. And he stopped by one door in a hallway, and the door on the right was closed, and the door on the left was open. He's like, wait right here, I'll be right back. So I'm standing there, and I just turn to my left, and I see probably five people having a meeting. It was a couple women and three men. And I just like, you know, the brain has the ability to kind of like tune in conversations. You can if you took a tape recording device and you just put it in a restaurant, you know, it would pick up every sound at the same time. But the brain has the ability to filter out all that other noise and just zero in on what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. That's what I was doing. And I was definitely doing like, because I was like, I don't know, I'm here, I'm kind of bored. And then one of the guys gets up really quickly and closes the door in my face. I was like, sorry. Anyway, so then Kevin comes back, and he comes back with John Klosklowski, the new head of Arrow. And we go into the room, close the door behind us, and we're in there. And he says, oh, yeah, this is my system. This is JWix. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm looking at the JWix computer system. Why don't I just tell this guy right now, hey, I think I know how to find what you're looking for. Like, there it was in his office, in his
cabin.
Wow. Right?
So let me just clarify.
Yes.
They will let a filmmaker into a skiff, but these good American legislators can't get into one.
Well, so Chris Mellon said to me, well, it might as well have been in a coffee shop. It doesn't matter. I don't think they revealed anything classified. I mean, I talked about stuff that they probably wouldn't talk about, but it was a skiff and I was inside. For whatever reason, they didn't meet me. They met me in a skiff.
Wow.
Yeah, I never thought I'd go into this game.
That's a great coup. Oh, my goodness. Well, I wish you the best on your return trip.
Right. But anyway, when I was in there and I was like, you know, I was saying like, hey, you know, there's this game. And who are these men in black? I was talking very candidly. Who are these men in black? And they were sitting there looking at me. You know, I was like, because they have an uncanny ability to monitor globally what's going on. I mean, they've shown up all around the world. I can give you 50 cases right now.
Yes.
You know, and I started rattling off different cases in Tehran and England, and Belgium and South America, and, you know, and I was like, why is it that this footage, all the compelling footage, most of it, not all of it, they do a pretty good job, but they're not 100% effective. They're probably 98% effective. Some photos slip between the cracks. Case in point, you know, it took 34 years or 33 years. Thank you, David Clark, for the Calvin UFO photograph to slip. But I asked him, I was like, you know, this stuff has an uncanny way of disappearing. These guys are intimidating. They're global. They just sat there listening to me. And I was like, you know that a lot of the cases, you know, sightings can be explained, but you know, we're dealing with probably 10, 15, 20% of this originate from a non-human intelligence. Like, you guys are running the Arrow. Like, what's the plan? How are you going to tell the public about this? Nobody said no. They said, John said, James, I can't part my hair without approval from the DOD. And you can quote me on that, which I thought was really interesting. He's basically saying my hands are tied. It doesn't matter what I uncover. It doesn't matter what's revealed to me or what I find. I'm unable to just go to a podium and announce to the world, hey, we're not alone. We got proof or whatever. Right. So it was really interesting. And I got 6 feet away from Zipper or JWix.
Wow.
6 feet away.
Now, Brigadier General Hamish Shed, who for 28 years was Israel's chief of space security.
Boy, he's made some crazy, crazy, crazy allegations.
He has. But one of the perhaps more accessible, more believable ones for a mainstream audience is that there has been collaboration behind closed doors that includes the USA and Israel, and possibly some other countries. How much international intelligence sharing is there on this? And I say international, clearly this would be from one small unit in one agency to another small unit in another agency. But it sounds like there's more international communication on this than the public might think.
No question. No question. I've investigated cases all around the world, Africa, China, Russia, South America, Africa. And it's amazing to me, and I've heard this both from civilians and from military abroad, that anytime you have a really good case, the Americans show up. And I could talk about how many examples I've got, but I've got lots. Now, I think that probably China less so. I didn't hear any reports of Americans in China investigating UFOs. Has it happened? I don't know. But I remember when I was in Russia in the late 90s. It was funny, actually, because I sat down. I think he might have been an admiral. I sat down with a general at Star City, Russia, General Alexeyev, he was a cosmonaut, Pavel Popovich. And their position at the time was, if you're here to talk about whether UFOs exist, the door is right over there. We want to talk about the implications, and we want to set up an international exchange of information with the Americans on this whole thing. But everywhere else, there was like evidence that the Americans were there. Like, I'll give you another example. I was investigating this alleged UFO crash that happened in Varginha, Brazil, which is about 4 hours north of Sao Paulo in the state of Minas Gerais. And it happened in 1996, January 1996. I think the crash happened a couple days earlier from the big main events that happened around the 20th. Anyway, I was investigating that case on and off for 12 years with my buddy Marco and a number of the other Brazilian researchers, which forever indebted to them for what was uncovered. But and I'd heard some rumblings about the U.S. involvement with that, but I really wasn't convinced. But on my last trip, I think it was 2022, there was a gentleman, Marco, I think Fernando, he was a flight control officer within the Brazilian military. And it's basically, I think, if the people that monitor all the incoming flights into Brazil, in particular regions in Brazil, you have to have certain authorization to be able to land. And they're monitoring all this, right? And that guy happened to come forward when I was there last filming. And he's like, I watched the USAF, he called it, United States Air Force plane, come in without government authorization to land. And he was like, this plane can't land. And it diverted from Sao Paulo to go to Campinas. And apparently a military, high-level military officer walked in the room and said, let it land. So I'd learned about the Americans' involvement. I was pretty damn convinced at that point that the Americans were involved. And I've uncovered additional things since then. But so I asked some intel folks, why would the Brazilians just let the U.S. come in and take what they found? Wouldn't the Brazilians want it? Wouldn't they want to do analysis? Wouldn't they want to do reverse engineering? And this individual who I trust, he said, I don't need the permission. They're coming in and taking it. We're coming in and we're taking it. We don't care what you think. Like, that's how that's the U.S. military rolls. Is it true? I suspect so, but that's how they do it.
I noticed that your witness, who was anonymous, didn't feel he was protected by the new whistleblower protection legislation. And I'm sure that legislation doesn't trump all America's official secrets laws. Will that legislation enable more people to come forward? Because it didn't really look like it, listening to that conversation.
No, I'm told that it needs to be bolstered. It needs to be better. People are terrified. I mean, even the people that participated, like, with their identity in the program, it doesn't matter. If you've seen the movie, you can see who they are. But I'm not going to name specifics, but they feel like there's a target on their back. They're very uncomfortable. And nobody came forward super willingly like, hey, I want to participate. Like, it wasn't like that. It's like, pretty much, please. Like, you know, I mean, Hal Putoff did it. He told me, Hal Putoff said, I'm doing this because he's not a very public guy. He doesn't go out and do, you know, for Hal to give me, you know, the interview that he gave me and the time that we spent together. He was taking some chances, even though he doesn't reveal a whole lot. Certainly the fact that he's talking to somebody that's going to publicize everything he's saying, I know he felt uncomfortable. And I know that other people felt very uncomfortable, but they didn't. Like Hal said, quite honestly, he's like, I'm doing this for my grandchildren.
Yes. When people watch the program, I would encourage people to take note of when the long pauses come after James's questions. And whenever James asks a question and the person says, I can't answer that, these are clearly questions that have an answer that cannot be spoken. There'll be an uncontroversial answer, but if they can't answer, then it's obviously the controversial answer that would follow. And James, I'd like to ask you if you spotted, here's the boundary, as you spoke to your various witnesses, did you find every time you came up to this question, that's when the curtains come down?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm looking at my chalkboard in front of me here. You can't see it because it's on the other side of the room, but I think one of my primary objectives, I'm looking at it right here. Where's the evidence and who has the authority to release it? That is one of the things that I was desperately trying to get answered. And, I think we make a pretty strong argument within the film that said evidence does exist. It's a matter of getting the street address. And I too am curious, like, is there, can the president of the United States wave their magic wand and provide immunity to these firsthand witnesses so they can come forward, you know, and feel safe and violate their NDAs and not go to prison? I'm looking into that now. What it would take, I don't know. That's the frustration. I read some comments and people get, you know, oh, just a big nothing burger. It's like, you guys, this is, if true, and obviously I'm convinced it is, I've been at it for a long, long time. This is the biggest story in modern history. And this secret has been so tightly held that, and they're losing the battle right now. I mean, I personally don't think they're putting the genie back in the bottle. I really don't. And many other people would say that's the case, that this is probably going to be acknowledged in some official capacity by 2030. And quite honestly, it maybe even sooner, but be patient. Be patient is all I can tell you. I'm doing the best I can with my limited resources to really get the answers. I want the same answers that you guys want. But this is definitely a tightly guarded secret. It's like we're up against Goliath, right? Like, about the resources and manpower and that they have and that we don't. But it's coming, and there are enough people that want it out. So we're living in unprecedented times, mate. you probably know that.
We certainly are. It's exciting days. I wanted to ask you, what is your read of NASA's role in this? And in particular, its current administrator, former senator and former astronaut, Bill Nelson. And you get to ask him a question at a press conference. And in that conference, he gives the impression that he's not very aware of what David Grush and his friends, he keeps referring to these other witnesses as David Grush.
Was so frustrating.
Yeah. How did you read that?
How did I read it? Well, first of all, if you go back a couple of years, he was actually quite outspoken about the observed technology that people like David Fravor had seen, right? Picked up on radar and all these various things. I mean, he was really making some rather profound statements, and he was being very, in my opinion, very transparent. I was flabbergasted by one of the officials that he was being as open as he was. In fact, he was one of my primary targets on the movie, but he kept denying me. Now, how did I feel about the David Grush part? Well, I'll tell you how I felt. You've got NASA, for the first time in history, in public, having a one-year-long UAP or UFO investigation. Now, they set themselves up, in my humble opinion, to fail because it was not having access to the classified data, and anyone that's looked into this knows that's the only way you're going to get anywhere is to have access to the classified data. I remember talking a year before when it was just announced that they were starting this year-long investigation that is going to fail because duh. But he did come forward and say, you know, UAP is real. We don't know what it is, but it's definitely real. And then he's like, but it's not extraterrestrial. We have no evidence. You know, so one of the questions I asked him was like, well, if you don't know what it is, how can you say what it isn't? You know, and I'm not saying that it is extraterrestrial. Maybe it's, you know. And the other thing is excuse me, somebody in the audience, thank God, brought this up. Or it must have been media. And they talked about David Grush because he had just testified under oath. Just, I don't know, a month earlier, maybe 6 weeks earlier. And I was expecting, you know, the head of NASA to say, hey, you know, we are in the midst of an investigation into the phenomenon ourselves. We take these allegations very seriously, particularly from a high level intel insider. We have not been able as of yet to, you know, prove or disprove his claims. However, it's an ongoing investigation and we'll comment at a later date. That, in my opinion, would have been an appropriate response. But he starts to do what I could only interpret as a smear campaign. I mean, he's like talking, oh, yeah, I think I heard about that in the evening news. Grush, yeah, Grush, didn't he have a friend that had a warehouse with an alien in a box in a warehouse? And then he claimed this and that. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a smear campaign. This isn't commentary. How could you possibly be in the midst of your own official UAP or UFO investigation, see a congressional hearing, hear about it in the news of the most incredible allegations in the history of the phenomenon? I mean, we've never had anything like it, right? Especially from someone in his position. And Congress set him up to go and find out what they knew. You know, to me, it felt like a smear campaign. No question about it. I was appalled by it. And I was talking to you earlier in the show.
Yes. Maybe
before we started recording, I said, revenge is a platter best served cold. And so I took my frustration and disappointment and I don't know. I think I put a little egg on his face in the edit room.
Well, he speaks for himself, and it's an enjoyable moment in the movie, but it represents the kind of exasperation that you must constantly face when making movies on this topic, when there is so much secrecy. But I absolutely agree with what you just said. It's his job to be researching this, and yet he claims he's unaware, pretty much, of the July 26th hearing. It clearly is not believable. It's laughable. And it just reminds me of some words of Ed Mitchell when he was asked, what does NASA know about ET contact? And he said, he's always very careful with his words. He said, officially, NASA does not know anything about this because that is not its mission. And I suspect its mission has not changed, listening to Bill Nelson in that press conference.
You know, it's interesting because I can't remember if it was just before or just after I flew to England and met with Gary McKinnon. And Gary McKinnon had faced life in prison as one of the biggest computer hackers into the intel communities in history at the time, maybe perhaps even still at this time. And he said that he was merely looking for evidence of UFOs, hidden evidence of UFOs. And he looked for over a year, maybe it was two, I don't remember. And he got pay dirt at the Johnson Space Center. And he talks about what he found. It was interesting, you know, obviously that was classified. And that UAP NASA investigation was based on unclassified information. Duh. Why would they do that? And but it was interesting. Like, I met with the head of NASA, and then I went and met with a guy who hacked into NASA. And then this is what he said he found, and he almost went to prison for life over it. And then that's the head of NASA saying, well, you know. So
yeah.
And it's really frustrating too when I hear people like Neil deGrasse Tyson or the head of NASA or other people that were involved in the UAP investigation at NASA. They literally talked about it at the press conference, the lack of more compelling data. When you know it exists, you know, it's like, are you guys not listening? Are you not in touch with other things that are being said? How could you be investigating this and not be hearing out people that ran? I mean, look at former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. He talks about what was leaked out in 2017 was merely the tip of the iceberg. He was the Senate Majority Leader.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Nelson was also a senator. How could they not know? He's also a Democratic senator. Of course they knew each other. Of course he must have been listening to what Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, former Senate Majority, was saying on camera, right? Like, he's not that out of touch. Please. Like, that made worldwide news. Like, he could address those issues. Well, there's been rumors circulating, or there's been, you know, credible accusations or accusations from credible people that there's a body of much more compelling data. We just can't find it, or we don't have the clearances to get access to it. That would be a far more believable and transparent response than the shit that he gave us, quite frankly. And that was incredibly frustrating. And I was to say that I was disappointed would be the world's big understatement. Like, come on, man. What do you think? We're stupid.
I love the pressure that you're keeping up on this, James, and I'm very grateful for others in the system who are. I love listening to Tim Burchett speak on this topic. He's got a real fire in his belly on this, as have other senators and members of Congress. I'm very grateful for my compatriot, Ross Coulthard, who's keeping this on the boil as well. I feel that we've got momentum. How do you see disclosure moving forwards?
Drip, drip, drip. You know, I remember, and funny enough, I've been communicating with some of the people in Arrow now. We communicate, and they're like, you know, you're making our job a lot. People like you are making our job a lot easier, because this is kind of how it needs to come out. It's not going to come out through us. It's going to come out through you. When I say me, I mean people like, you know, us filmmakers, researchers. I mean, Ross Coulthard, he is, I don't even know if I envy his position, quite honestly. I wouldn't want it. He's in deep. Like, the stories that I've been hearing and what's going to drop this year, some of the stuff, I mean, I can't even, because I don't know. He, you know, yeah, I've heard, boy, that
You've guy. Heard some things, yes.
Yeah, I've heard some things that are coming, like, oh my God. You know, and it's like you pull back the curtain and you find something, and all of a sudden you're a target, right? Well, I've been, you know, I'm a much more mild version of that, but I've definitely, you know, I do my research. I'm kind of quiet during the time I'm making movies, and then I put my movies out, let the audience, you know, draw their own conclusions, try not to make any definitive statements. And if you like what I'm doing, buy my movie, support this movement, you know, great. And then I do a little bit, I do a tour for a few weeks of podcasts and radio, whatever. And then I go back at my thing, and I take, you know, usually it used to be several years. I've whittled it down to a lot sooner because things are happening so fast. It's going to be obsolete by the time it comes out, but at least I'm recording some of this stuff that's happening, you know, in history, right? Like, and the program, quite honestly, is like, it's a moment in history that's being recorded and documented, and thank God that we have that, because holy smokes, like, if this stuff turns out to be true, and obviously I'm convinced it is, this is beyond a shadow of doubt the biggest story ever. ever.
Exactly. James, you've made three phenomenal movies back to back. The Phenomenon, Moment of Contact, now The Program. Where next? What are you going to do next?
I'm going to Brazil in 36 hours.
All right. Back to Brazil.
Yes, sir. Yeah. In fact, when is this episode drop?
Probably we can get this out within the next week or so.
Okay. The reason why I ask is because by the time people are looking at this, I'm going to be knocking on doors in Varginha, Brazil. So,
all right.
Might be in the States right now, but actually when you're watching this, I'll be in Brazil. Yeah. So I'm doing that. And then I'm probably going to do an event at the National Press Club, quite similar to what I did in 2007 with Leslie Kane.
Oh, fantastic.
Make a movie about that because things are happening so quickly. That's certainly a high level of probability I'm going to do that. And then I'll probably do a sequel to The Program. And then I'd like to take a year off and then just kind of spend time with my son.
Oh, gosh, you will have earned that, James, for sure. Before you go, tell people how we can keep up with your work so we know from month to month, year to year, what you're up to.
I post things on my formerly known as Twitter, X account, at James C as in Charlie Fox, at James C Fox. I post things often, usually daily, at least bi-weekly. The film is currently on Apple and Amazon. It's coming on to more platforms as the days go by. And again, if you like this independent filmmaking and what I bring to the table, and you can afford it, rent it, buy it, and it's greatly appreciated because this stuff is it's not easy.
Speaking for the Fifth Kind, we love the work you do, James. Keep doing it, and we will very much look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you so much, Paul. I greatly appreciate you guys having me on. I really do.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. For uncensored access to our full interviews and documentaries, go to fifthkind.tv. For more videos about Paleo Contact and the wisdom of the world's ancestral narratives, go to the Paul Wallace channel, subscribe, and click on the bell. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV.